Welcome back to the story of Esther. We're back in chapter one, and we left off sitting cross-legged with the kids at Purim. Grandpa's almost ready to start up the story again, which I was hoping would be a girl power story for my daughters. But so far, not so much. Now keep in mind, this is a story. This is not God's law, and neither is it a wisdom book or epistle. And a story is not meant for moralizing. It doesn't tell us what's right or wrong. It just tells us what happened, even if it's messed up. And there's a lot of messed up here. Some actions are right, some wrong, and sometimes it's just complicated. The power of story is the opportunity for us to ponder and to see ourselves in it. With Bible stories, we also get to see God working through the lives of real people, sometimes in miraculous and powerful ways. Other times, it's harder to see God, and we have to search. That's why it's so important to hear this story with fresh ears, to enter in and look around, to feel the tension and wrestle with each challenge. And that's why we're sitting with the kids, to hear the story through their ears, because kids ask the best questions without foregone conclusions. Now, while we have a short pause from the story, let me catch you up on the timeline and where this fits into Bible history. It's about 483 BC. The Israelites were exiled into Babylon some 122 years earlier in 605. But the Medes conquered Babylon, and the exile officially ended with King Cyrus's decree in 539. Then Zerubbabel led the return to Jerusalem in the 520s, and the temple was rebuilt. That's all done at this point. The Book of Esther lands on the timeline in the 480s BC in a half-century gap between Ezra 6 and Ezra 7, after the temple rebuilding but before the city rebuilding in Jerusalem. But on the map, we're a long ways from Jerusalem. We're in Persia, in the city of Susa. On a modern map, that's in Iran, about 1,500 kilometers from Jerusalem. Now, the biblical heartbeat of this time period is God's repeated invitation to his people. It's a time of returning to the promised land, and in Nehemiah, Zechariah, and Malachi, the Lord repeats the call, "Return to me, and I will return to you." And again in Haggai, "I am with you," declares the Lord. But those words were for those who moved back, the remnant. What about those who didn't return? Will God be with them, way out here? And that's why I like this story, because our world can feel a whole lot like that, like we're a long way from the promised land, and we wonder if God will even bother to show up in our story. Speaking of story, back in Persia, we left off with King Xerxes finishing off a grand six-month exhibition of his vast treasures in the citadel of Susa. Historians tell us that Xerxes has an ulterior motive here. He wants all those nobles to support his upcoming war plans for Greece, after his father's army was defeated at the famous Battle of Marathon. The exhibition closed with a week-long banquet of luxury for the nobles, along with everyone who lives and works in the citadel. Well, all the men, anyway. The women feasted with Queen Vashti, until King Xerxes decided he wanted to show off his beautiful queen. Nothing inspires men for battle like a beautiful woman. But Vashti wasn't interested in being put on display. Now, Xerxes is furious. Okay, looks like Grandpa's ready to start up again. We better sit down. Esther chapter 1, verse 13. Since it was customary for the king to consult experts in matters of law and justice, he spoke with the wise men who understood the times and were closest to the king, Karshina, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Merez, Marcina, and Memucan, the seven nobles of Persia and Media who had special access to the king and were highest in the kingdom. The top men, wise men. A little ironic, though. Who better to consult in an argument with your wife than a bunch of men? They'll know. They understand women. You can laugh, but we still do it, men, even in church. Verse 15. According to law, what must be done to Queen Vashti? He asked. She has not obeyed the command of King Xerxes that the eunuchs have taken to her. Now, don't miss the biblical ironies here. The king consults the wise men about the law. If this were in Israel, the wisdom and law would be very different. In Proverbs, wisdom is personified as a woman. And Proverbs 31 is a full chapter of advice from a king's mom to her son to honor and respect his wife, to recognize all she does and empower her. Something tells me this king won't get that advice here. As for law, God's law specifically instructed the kings not to multiply wives, or gold for that matter. A harem was definitely banned. God's law consistently protects women and anyone marginalized. Out in the world, most ancient laws just protected the wealthy and powerful. None of this would happen under God's wisdom and God's law in Israel. Wait a second. That's not actually entirely true. It was, in fact, banned by God's law, but it all still happened. Israel's kings didn't exactly pay attention to those rules. They multiplied wives and gold. In many ways, that was the beginning that ultimately forced Israel into exile, hearts led astray by ungodly pursuits, starting with the king. Okay, we better get back to the story. Grandpa's losing patience with me. Verse 16. Then Memucan replied in the presence of the king and the nobles, "Queen Vashti has done wrong, not only against the king, but also against all the nobles and the peoples of all the provinces of King Xerxes. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, and so they will despise their husbands and say, 'King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she would not come.' This very day, the Persian and Median women of the nobility who have heard about the queen's conduct will respond to all the king's nobles in the same way. There will be no end of disrespect and discord." Basically, wise Memucan says that disrespect to one man is disrespect to all men. King Xerxes, control your woman. Sorry, Grandpa. I know it's a story. I'll be quiet. Verse 19. "Therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree, and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, which cannot be repealed, that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. Also, let the king give her royal position to someone else who is better than she." All right, Grandpa, I have to interrupt, at least for my daughters. Son-in-law, you should listen too. The solution of the wise men is so incredibly pig-headed, it's laughable. You're upset with your wife? Get rid of her. Now, for good. Then find an upgrade. What? Is this how you solve relationship problems? But some guys really are that dumb. I can't change, so I'll just change my partner. Or change to a new partner. I know. I'm sorry, Grandpa. I'll stop. Verse 20. "Then when the king's edict is proclaimed throughout all his vast realm, all the women will respect their husbands, from the least to the greatest." Yeah, great solution, guys. This is how you earn a woman's respect. Son-in-law, please note my sarcasm. Now, don't misunderstand. Ephesians 5 says quite plainly, the wife must respect her husband. In the Bible, respect is key to marriage. But respect demanded by force is subjugation and thoroughly unbiblical. Ephesians calls godly men to lay your life down for your wife and walk worthy of her respect. I know, Grandpa, I said no moralizing. I just couldn't resist. Sorry. Please continue. By the way, does anyone else picture Peter Falk in The Princess Bride here? Just me? Anywho, verse 21. "The king and his nobles were pleased with this advice. So the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent dispatches to all parts of the kingdom, to each province in its own script, and to each people in their own language, proclaiming that every man should be ruler of his own household, using his native tongue." And there you have the state of things. The perfect finish for the opening chapter of Esther. Some girl power story. And that ending, a proclamation to every part of the kingdom that every man should be ruler over his own household. Where's the girl power in that? I mean, at face value, it's not unbiblical. Ephesians says that the husband is the head of the wife, right? And wife, respect your husband. So why does this version feel so ungodly? There's a lesson here for us today. Godly principles taken to ungodly extremes are dangerous. When godly directives are abused and ungodly actions are excused, something's not right. Back here in Persia, God is still nowhere to be seen. Where is he? A full chapter in and still no mention. We need you, Lord. We need you. Read Esther 1, and we'll keep looking next time.
Join us next time as we continue the journey, one chapter at a time. And remember, faith comes by hearing, and hearing through the word.